When Professor Tom Neal, a member of this church, mentioned a couple of weeks ago that Earth Day was coming up, and wouldn't it be nice if we paid some attention to it, my mind had a quick double response. I am not fond of having pulpit topics mandated by the calendar and all its special days. Mother's Day, which struck someone years ago as a lovely idea, and then Father's Day, because dads are nice too, and also, let's be honest, to cash in on a good marketing idea. And now we have Grandparents' Day in the early fall, which is a nice time of year, I suppose, for those who are approaching winter. It's conceivable that Nephews and Nieces Day may be next, since so many of us have several. That is, if we can find a place for still another calendar commitment, along with Memorial Day, Flag Day, Pentecost, Bosses Day, Secretary's Day, even, believe it or not, a special Saturday in October, which is called Sweetest Day. Sermons, I think, ought not to be determined by all these events. So when Tom made his remark, I recalled out loud my worries about special interest groups, a comment so wonderfully absurd and inappropriate that Tom and I both woke up in the middle of the night with allergic reactions to it. Tom, being a kind and generous man, has forgiven me. I'm having a little harder time forgiving myself. Because if ever a celebration was not the property of a special interest group, this would have to be the one. Pentecost means nothing to my Jewish friends. Not everybody had a good mother. Memorial Day is a little difficult for pacifists. And I'm not sure the curmudgeons among us, one of whom is speaking, could tolerate the high sugar content of Sweetest Day. But this day, Earth Day, ought surely to be crucial for everyone in this room, for every living soul on this vulnerable planet. Because it's hard to imagine anyone who reads or listens who doesn't know that we are in trouble. Old Dr. Samuel Johnson said once, when a man knows he is to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. I should think it would. Any sentence of death can cause startling changes in our priorities. Trivia flakes off like dandruff. The essentials stand out in stark relief. Apparently, the threat of impending ecological doom is having something of that effect on public opinion, because concern for the environment is at an all-time high and not a day too soon. The Alaskan oil spill shocked us with those images of dead birds and sea otters and miles of tar-smeared beaches, but it was trivial compared to other disasters happening around the world. It is no longer somebody's wild guess that more and more of Earth is turning into desert, that great rainforests are shrinking at an incredible rate, that oil consumption is on its way back up, and that interest in alternate sources of energy has waned, that garbage ships sail around the seas trying in vain to find a harbor, that beaches clogged with styrofoam cups and chunks and carelessly dumped medical wastes, that acid rain has made lakes barren that once were rich in bass and pike, that underground aquifers are endangered by reckless use, that groundwater reeks of industrial waste, that species it took millions of years to develop are disappearing at an astonishing rate, and that human population has quite literally run amok. Every single one of those disasters is made more dangerous by the last one, the explosion of Earth's human population. On my own list of the gravest dangers, this one has been in first place for years because it compounds every other problem we can imagine. Last year, 87 million more human beings were born. Taken aboard a finite spaceship to become breathers of air, eaters of food, burners of fuel. Within 35 years, it appears, we will double the population from over 5 billion to over 10 billion. I know of nothing except a cosmic collision more likely to make life unendurable. We knew all this, theoretically, from the things we had read, but I think something changed forever in many of us. I know it did in me. When we saw that first picture of what our planet looked like from out in space, when those of us older than 30 were children, the Earth seemed immense and indestructible. We would get into our car and head for the Rockies across 500 miles of immutable and monotonous land, thinking as the hours dragged slowly by that we would have to drive 50 times that far to circle the planet. What a huge and formidable mass it was, this huge globe which the science textbooks had described for us. But when we actually saw that small blue and white marble hanging in space that dwarfs it, the only beautiful and comforting thing we have seen out in the eternal darkness, then suddenly it looked fragile for the first time. And we began to realize that we had better make love to it instead of raping it. And that we had better get serious about how many passengers we can welcome onto our spacecraft before we have too many. I've told you many times how great a debt we owe the Catholic Church for the preservation of culture during some very dark times. And I have said often how great my own personal debt is for the biblical scholarship of people like Bruce Vauter and Father Raymond Brown and Hans Küng and John McKenzie and so many other extraordinary Catholic students whose fearless, intelligent analysis of Scripture has enriched my understanding. I am a Protestant who gladly honors his Catholic Christian friends for uncountable gifts to our past and our present. But I wish, with all my heart and mind, that this great church could find it possible to rethink its position on birth control and help us limit the population explosion, especially in third world countries where it has such enormous potential for disaster. Now, I cannot expect the Vatican to go against its own conscience, but I would like to see happen what happened once in the matter of charging interest for lending money. For centuries, the church had said that it was a sin to do this, a sin against God because of ancient Jewish law, and a sin against nature based on the logic of Aristotle. But as the Renaissance spread and the modern world began and capital was needed, and those who had capital to offer wanted to charge interest to protect against risk, and it became apparent that great fortunes could be made, and that indeed Jewish moneylenders were making them because they were not deterred from lending money at interest, when all those compelling reasons began to pile up, the great scholars of the church got together, reviewed the whole matter of lending money at interest, and decided that it was all right, after all, that it was not a sin, but good sense. I have to hope, when I read how many people will inhabit this planet in the next two generations, that a similar change in doctrine might take place with regard to birth control. I'm not encouraged by what I see of modern technology when some ardent believer tells me not to worry, that we will find a way to feed and house two or three times as many people as the world has now, and that in the last extremity, God will provide. I've long held the opinion that when God gave us the great gift of common sense, He expected us to use it. And I do see Earth Day as a call to start using it. Footnote: if you'd like to read the fascinating story of how the church changed its doctrine about charging interest, you'll find it in R.H. Tawney's book, Religion and the Rise of Capitalism, Chapter 2. It's worth reading. I am not honoring the environmental movement this morning because of media pressure, although I'm happy for it, but because I am truly convinced that unless we change our ways, we will make the earth unfit for life. Not in my lifetime, or yours perhaps, but for unborn generations who have no way of knowing the legacy we are selfishly preparing for them. Do we care? Is it, on this lovely Sunday morning, the church's business? If we really believe that God is the author of life, that His Spirit brooded in love over this spinning planet and filled it with an incredible diversity of living forms, how many things could be more important than preserving what He gave us? And above all else, the one point I want to make this morning is that small, seemingly trivial decisions by millions of people can make a difference. I'm glad some of our own children are planting trees this very moment on church property as part of their observance of Earth Day. I think the lesson on Noah and the Ark can wait a week. I've had my consciousness raised about energy until I remember very often now to turn on the shower briefly to get wet, to turn it off during the soaping and scrubbing process, and then to turn it back on only to rinse, instead of luxuriating in that wonderful, wasteful waterfall for 15 minutes as I used to do. I can't even leave the faucet run wide open anymore while I brush my teeth, although I've made no converts close to home. Multiply that wasted gallon or so of water, warm water to boot, since most brushers who require background waterfall noise do not like to rinse with cold water. Multiply that by several hundred million people and by twice a day and see what a trivial change in habits would add up to. I must ask, since we are at worship in a church, whether it is our business as a community of faith to love the earth, or whether that is just a form of contemporary paganism. If you really wonder, try reading the 104th Psalm every morning at breakfast for a week. Like many of the other Hebrew songs, like certain chapters of magnificent poetry in the book of Job, it is a lyric of ecstatic praise to God for the bounty and the beauty of the earth. O Lord my God, how great you are. You spread out the skies like a great tent. You make clouds to be your chariot, and you ride on the wings of the wind. You made the earth to be strong and solid. You set a boundary for the seas and made the land to be safe from the deep. The hills rose up, the valleys sank down to the place you made for them. If this ancient poet had known the hymn we heard this morning, "For the Beauty of the Earth," he might have stopped right there to sing it before he turned his vision from distant miracles and brought them closer home, like this: "You water the land until grass grows for the cattle and fodder for the beasts that serve us. You water the land to bring food from the earth, wine to cheer our hearts, olive oil to make our skin shine, bread to sustain our strength." "Well, that's nice," my practical brother-in-law told me one day. "But you notice how practical this guy is? He's thanking God for the essentials of life, for the things we can use and the things we can sell. I like this fellow." And I said, "Read on. Watch this true lover of the earth praise God, even for the things that are of no obvious and practical use, not just for the valuable cattle and the wine and the nourishing corn, but for aesthetic joy, for the springs that bubble up mysteriously from the earth and make pools where wild animals can come to drink, for wild birds that settle and sing among the branches of trees, for storks who make nests in the cypress, for the rugged hill country where the wild goat and the gentle marmot can live in safety. This is not a man looking for some way to exploit the earth for profit. This is a man intoxicated by the wonder and beauty of the earth, even by the fierce struggle for survival that is part of its mystery. Listen, you make it dark, night falls, and every wild beast in the wood is moving, lions roaring for their prey and claiming food from God. When the sun rises, then they slink away to lie down in their lairs while we human beings come out to work and labor until the evening. There's even this glance far out to sea where no Jew ever very willingly went. How manifold thy works, Eternal One. Yonder the sea lies, vast and broad, with its countless creatures, small and great, with the great whales that play and enjoy themselves. May the glory of the Lord last forever. Overwhelmed by what he sees, he ends his poem with a fervent prayer that must be rising from 100,000 churches and synagogues around the world on this Earth Day Sunday morning. May the glory of the Lord last forever.